This podcast contains descriptions of violence against children and adult language and is not suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised. Guys, and welcome to Suffer the Little Children, the true crime podcast giving voices back to the victims of child abuse and shining a harsh spotlight on the parents, guardians, and caretakers who silence them. I'm your host, Lane, and this is episode 44, Case Update Special number 2. In my last episode, I updated you on the first dozen or so cases I covered on the podcast. In this episode, I'll provide updates on the next several cases I covered from episodes 13 to 24. My sources for this episode were Lubbock Online, Everything Lubbock, The Daily Item, The Journal Times, The Waco Tribune Herald, KCEN-TV, Facebook, 7 News, North Country Public Radio, O'Leary Funeral Service, The Highland County Press, News 5 Cleveland, Fox 11, various county and state court and jail portals, and in some cases, family members. I hope you all had a happy, healthy, safe holiday season. I know we're all looking forward to better things in 2021. I'm approaching it with caution for sure, but I am an eternal optimist, and not even 2020 could dampen that. My wish for all of you is the best year yet. I did take a week off myself over the holidays, and although I had the best intentions of checking my social media and email at least daily, I let that fall by the wayside too. It turns out I really needed that mental break, but I'm back now, and I have every intention of continuing to release weekly episodes. Before I get into the updates, I'd like to give a shout-out to my newest patrons, Emily from Asheville, North Carolina, Lisa from Jessup, Georgia, and Deanne from Crescent, Oklahoma. Thank you all so much for your support. Every pledge brings me that much closer to my goal of permanently devoting myself full-time to the blog and the podcast, and your support means the world to me. If you've pledged and haven't received an email from me, please send me an email at sufferthelittlechildren.pod@gmail.com. I've tried my best to stay caught up, but if I missed you, I truly apologize, and I want to make sure I get in touch with you. If anyone else would like to make a monthly donation to help me reach my goal, you can visit www.sufferthelittlechildrenpod.com and click Become a Patron in the upper right-hand corner. To make a one-time donation, you can visit www.sufferthelittlechildrenblog.com/support. Again, thank you all so much for your support of every kind. Next up, I'd like you to hear a promo for another great true crime podcast, Once Upon a Nightmare.
Hello, this is Lorraine, your host from Once Upon a Nightmare. Every Tuesday, I like to delve into the horrors of the world, be it fiction or real. I've had a healthy and what some will call a strange obsession with true crime and horror movies for well over 30 years now. So if those two topics pique your interest, then please go check out Once Upon a Nightmare podcast. It is available on multiple platforms. And don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Thank you.
Finally, before I get started with today's updates, there's one more thing I wanted to mention. In December, Suffer the Little Children podcast reached a huge milestone by surpassing 100,000 downloads. In fact, as of this recording, my all-time download number is 112.7 thousand. That doesn't even count YouTube, where I was shocked to find out that all of my episodes combined had 59.1 thousand total views. While I was at it, I figured I should check the blog stats, and I almost fell off my chair when I saw that in 2020 alone, I had over 1.1 million page views and almost 803,000 visitors to the site. You guys, I don't even have the words to express my gratitude. Thank you all so much for listening, watching, clicking, reading, commenting, rating, reviewing, liking, subscribing, and every other possible way you've supported me along this journey. When I published my first post on Suffer the Little Children blog in May of 2019, I had no idea how thoroughly I would immerse myself in these stories and how much I would come to love these kids, who aren't even my own, but each of whom occupies a place in my heart. I'm honored to be able to tell their stories to so many people, to make their voices heard, and to help keep their memories alive. Thank you all from the bottom of my heart for all of your support. I wouldn't and couldn't be doing this without you guys. With that, let's get into today's episode. In episode 13, I told you the heartbreaking story of 10-month-old Marion Rebecca Aviana Jester Montoya, a sweet, happy baby with dark hair and an unmistakable sparkle in her big brown eyes, whose father and his family absolutely adored and doted on her. Marion split her time between the home of her mother, Veronica Weems, and her father, Emilio Montoya, both of whom lived in or around Lubbock, Texas. On January 7, 2020, almost exactly a year ago, Veronica's boyfriend, Trevor Rowe, who was also a childhood friend of Emilio's, took Marion to work with him instead of dropping her off at a family member's house for the day. You might think it would be difficult to care for an infant while working as a roofer. Well, so did Trevor, who crammed the little girl into a backpack, zipped it up, and left it in the trunk of his Dodge Charger all day, only returning once at lunchtime to check on Marion while he ate his own lunch and let the baby go hungry. When he finished work at around 5 p.m., Trevor found Marion pale, not breathing, and unresponsive, and she was later pronounced dead at the hospital. This story is an unthinkable tragedy, compounded by the fact that Marion's daddy, Emilio, lost his older sister in 2017 and his father in 2019. Since Marion's death, he also lost an uncle. The Montoya family has been through an unbearable amount of sorrow and pain, and my heart goes out to them. Since I covered Marion's story in May of last year, there have been very few updates on the case against Trevor Rowe, who I've taken to calling Rat Boy on the blog. When you see his picture in the Facebook album for this episode, you'll understand why. He resembles vermin in more ways than one. The court case has been essentially stalled in the court system due to the COVID-19 pandemic. As of right now, the Montoya family is just watching and waiting for news of any hearing, let alone a trial date being set. The one update I do have is that in November of 2020, the Montoya family was given a much-deserved blessing when Emilio's sister, Katrina, gave birth to her third child, a baby girl. While of course Marion can never be replaced, at the very least, the new baby can give them hope and something positive to focus on. I truly hope they get justice soon for Marion, and that they're able to find peace and comfort, especially with the approaching anniversary of Marion's death and what should have been her second birthday on February 10th. Episode 14 was devoted to a precious little 3-year-old angel with a halo of curly blonde hair and more personality than most adults. Her name was Charlotte Dawkins, and at the time of her death in 2017, she lived with her mother, Caitlin Royston, and Caitlin's then-fiancé, Travis Graham, in Blackwood, New Jersey. Charlotte was loved by everyone who ever met her, and her family's lives essentially revolved around her. On March 13, 2017, Charlotte was home alone with Travis while Caitlin was at work. Travis's story changed a number of times after the fact, but it was ultimately revealed that, supposedly as retaliation for Charlotte pinching him, Travis dealt the little girl a backhand blow to the face, sending her tumbling down a steep flight of wooden stairs. Rather than immediately seeking medical attention, Travis waited 3 full hours before taking Charlotte to the emergency room. Due to the seriousness of her injuries, Charlotte was airlifted to Cooper University Hospital in Camden and placed in the pediatric intensive care unit, where doctors found she had suffered a severe traumatic brain injury. They also found multiple rib fractures and bruises on Charlotte's forehead, chest, abdomen, and legs, indicating she had been abused over time. The following day, March 14, 2017, Charlotte's family was told their little princess had no brain activity and could not survive her injuries. At this point, Caitlin agreed to donate Charlotte's organs, but instead of sitting by her daughter's bedside until her organs could be harvested, she signed medical authority over to Charlotte's 20-year-old godmother, Kirsten, and promptly left the hospital with Travis, even after being told by medical staff that Charlotte's injuries indicated abuse that was undoubtedly caused by the last person she was with. Kirsten remained by Charlotte's bedside for days until her goddaughter, who she called Little Babe, was removed from life support. Despite the highly suspicious circumstances surrounding Charlotte's death, Caitlin continued to defend Travis, causing rifts in almost all of her familial relationships. 7 months after Charlotte died, Caitlin gave birth to Travis's daughter, who was removed immediately from the couple's custody. In February of 2018, Caitlin married Travis, who had since turned to heroin use and armed robbery. Travis was arrested in July of 2018 and charged with robberies in several counties in New Jersey, at which time he also gave contradictory accounts of the events of the day Charlotte was injured. When Charlotte's autopsy results were finally released in August of 2018, Travis was at last charged with first-degree murder and endangering the welfare of a child. Almost a year later, he accepted a plea deal, pleading guilty to a reduced charge of aggravated manslaughter in Charlotte's death, as well as three counts of conspiracy to commit armed robbery. In July of 2019, during a sentencing hearing at which several family members gave gut-wrenching impact statements, Superior Court Judge Gwendolyn Blue sentenced 23-year-old Travis Wayne Graham to a total of 30 years in state prison, of which he must serve a minimum of 25 and a half years. He will be under 50 when he walks out of prison. Since birth, Charlotte's baby sister, who I'll call E, was placed in the home of a family member, where she flourished in a loving, stable environment. It was, however, the clear intent of New Jersey's Division of Child Protection and Permanency, or DCP&P, to reunify E with her mother, even though the same agency had ruled that Caitlin bore some responsibility for Charlotte's death because she did not make reasonable efforts to protect her child. Caitlin was never criminally charged in connection with Charlotte's death. Since I released episode 14, despite at least two Change.org petitions attempting to prevent reunification of E with her biological mother, which were sent to the judge as well as other political figures and law enforcement, E was in fact removed from her family member's home and placed with Caitlin, who was at the time living with her mother, Renee. However, very shortly after she and her three-year-old daughter were reunified, Caitlin and Renee had a falling out, and Caitlin took her daughter and left her family's home. No one in the family has seen E in months. That's unfortunately the only update I have on Charlotte's story, and I just continue to hope and pray that Caitlin has learned to put her child first before any man, and that little E's story has a much happier ending than Charlotte's did. In episode 15, I told you the horrific story of 12-year-old Eduardo Paso, who was carried into the emergency room in Bloomington, Indiana in May of 2019, but it was too late to save him. Eduardo weighed between 50 and 55 pounds at the time of his death, with 0% body fat. Hospital staff saw signs of extreme abuse on the little boy's severely emaciated body, including bruising, lacerations, and ulcers, and police began an investigation that led to the arrests of Eduardo's father, Luis Paso, and stepmother, Diana Medina Flores. The couple, who had recently begun traveling the country as advertising contractors for a circus, had lived for several days at the Economy Inn in Bloomington, where police allege they kept Eduardo restrained in the bathtub with wrist and ankle chains and a shock collar designed for a dog, monitoring him with a webcam attached to the towel bar. Their other three children, all of whom appeared healthy and well-nourished, were placed in protective custody. The children told police that Eduardo was punished because he was bad and not part of the family. Investigators found incriminating texts, photos, and videos on Luis and Diana's phones, including a video of Eduardo restrained in the bathtub and a selfie of Luis with Eduardo chained up in the background. Worse still, it was found that CPS in Florida's Manatee County, where the family lived prior to embarking on their latest endeavor, had visited the Pasos 5 times in a period of approximately 18 months on tips from Eduardo's biological mother, his grandmother, his school, and anonymous tipsters. There have been no updates of note in Eduardo's case since the episode was released, other than the seemingly constant scheduling and rescheduling of court hearings. Neither Luis Paso nor Diana Medina Flores has yet been to trial, despite the case dragging on for over a year and a half now. It appears the two will be tried separately. Diana's trial was scheduled for September and October of 2019, but it has been canceled and rescheduled a couple times since then. At this point, Diana's final pretrial conference is scheduled for March 4, 2021 at 11 a.m., and her trial is scheduled to begin with jury selection on April 8 at 8:30 a.m. She requires a Spanish interpreter in the courtroom. Luis was scheduled for trial in May of 2020, but it was adjourned indefinitely. In September of 2020, a motion hearing was held in Luis's case, during which, according to Indiana's My Case portal, record taken, witnesses sworn, and evidence presented. The state of Indiana entered 12 exhibits, all of which were admitted by the court without objection, although it was not specified what the evidence was. And to my great chagrin, not a single Indiana news outlet appears to be following this case. Luis's attorneys, Kyle Duggar and Justin Rohde, have filed a motion to suppress, to which prosecuting attorney Erica Oliphant filed a rebuttal brief in November. Luis is scheduled for a pretrial conference on January 7, 2021, at 2:45 p.m., the day after this episode is released. If his trial date is scheduled after that hearing, I'll make sure to post an update on sufferthelittlechildrenblog.com. Both Luis and Deanna's trials will be overseen by Monroe County Circuit Court Judge Christine Talley Haysman. The next case I covered on the podcast, which encompassed episodes 16 and 17, was that of 3-year-old Arabella Parker. A 911 call on October 10, 2019, summoned EMTs to an apartment on West Shamokin Street in Treverton, Pennsylvania, where a tiny, red-haired, 3-year-old girl was reportedly suffering a seizure. In truth, Arabella had been badly beaten. Doctors who examined her found she had suffered bruised lungs, internal abdominal bleeding, 3 broken ribs on the right side, and 8 on the left, fractures of both collarbones, bruises all over her face and body, vaginal hemorrhaging, bilateral hematoma, and acute brain bleeding. Her brain damage was so severe that part of her brain had to be removed and she was placed on life support. The following day, police arrested Jared Burgess, the live-in boyfriend of Arabella's mother, Samantha Del Camp, and accused Jared of beating Arabella to the brink of death. A criminal complaint alleged that Jared had a habit of beating both Arabella and Samantha, tossing them around, punching, kicking, and even stomping them. The complaint stated that Jared was interviewed and admitted to his involvement in Arabella's injuries. He was charged with 3 counts of aggravated assault, 1 count of strangulation, 1 count of simple assault, 1 count of endangering the welfare of children, and 1 count of recklessly endangering another person. Arabella clung to life in the hospital for the next several weeks. Samantha remained free, telling reporters and anyone who would listen that she had been too afraid of Jared to leave the relationship. She also claimed she was being harassed and threatened by members of the community for her perceived failure to protect her daughter. On October 22nd, Samantha and her mother, Bonnie, traveled to Connecticut to film an appearance on The Steve Wilkos Show, where the show's host gave literally zero credence to Samantha's claims of being abused. After he essentially tore her a new one to the delight of the studio audience, he tore up the results of her polygraph test without even looking at them, telling her he didn't need a polygraph to tell him she was one of the worst mothers he had ever featured on his show. Savage. Although the program wasn't scheduled to air until November, investigators were able to view the footage well ahead of time. District Attorney Tony Matulowicz later said that Samantha's comments on the show confirmed their suspicions and that there continued to be discrepancies in the versions of the story she told various people. On October 24th, Samantha was arrested on felony charges of endangering the welfare of children, obstruction of a child abuse case, and hindering apprehension for prosecution. On October 30th, 2019, Jared's mother, Christy Willis, was also arrested and accused of providing false and misleading statements to stymie the investigation into Arabella's death. It turned out Christy was the person who placed the 911 call reporting Arabella's seizures on October 10th. Jared and Samantha had waited over 50 minutes for Christy to arrive because of her expertise as a nurse's aide. In the meantime, with the blessing of Arabella's father, Carl Parker, who was in prison for parole violation, Samantha's sister, Mandy, was given temporary emergency custody of her small niece. In November, Arabella suffered a stroke, which caused her brain to bleed and fill with fluid. Doctors told the family that even if she survived, Arabella would never wake up. Mandy was forced to make the difficult decision to remove Arabella from life support, which was done on November 20th. Arabella survived for 2 more days, finally succumbing to her injuries on November 22nd, 2019. The charges against both Jared and Samantha were subsequently upgraded to murder. Since I released episodes 16 and 17, there have been a few updates on Arabella's case. Jared Burgess, Samantha Del Camp, and Christy Willis all continue to await trial. In June of 2020, Jared and his defense team filed a motion requesting that footage of his interview with Pennsylvania state troopers after Arabella was injured not be allowed in court, claiming Jared asked for an attorney but was not provided with one. Northumberland County President Judge Charles Saylor reviewed 6 hours of interview footage, during which he said Jared was given repeated opportunities to take a break from questioning, but declined each time. Jared's motion was denied, meaning the interview footage will be seen at trial. Since their arrests, Jared and Samantha have pointed the finger at each other. As I mentioned a few minutes ago, the criminal complaint initially filed in the case stated that Jared had admitted his involvement to investigators. If his admission took place during the recorded interview sessions, prosecutors have this in the bag, and I would anticipate Jared will seek a plea deal, but time will tell. In October of 2020, word came out that Samantha was in ongoing negotiations with the Northumberland County District Attorney's Office. DA Tony Matulowicz would not comment on the case, but Samantha's attorney, Michael O'Donnell, hinted to a reporter that the negotiations between the defense and the prosecution may result in a plea agreement. As yet, no agreement has been reached. Most recently, on December 27th, not even 2 weeks ago, Nick Cayley, the husband of Samantha's mother, Bonnie, was found dead in a home on Walnut Street in Sunbury, Pennsylvania. Nick, who had a young son of his own, had his share of troubles, including drug problems and an extensive criminal history. In September of 2019, he was charged with aggravated assault after allegedly causing an incident in which the van he was driving smashed head-on into a school bus full of children. The van was found to contain heroin, methamphetamine, glycine bags, and copper pipe at the time of the accident, and authorities believe Nick was under the influence. Within weeks of that incident, while Arabella clung to life in the hospital, Nick was arrested again and accused of punching his wife, Bonnie. Regardless, he attended a subsequent vigil honoring Arabella with the family. Both court cases were pending at the time of Nick's death, which, according to his obituary, occurred after losing his ongoing battle with addiction. Nick's obituary stated,
"He enjoyed being outdoors. He liked hunting, fishing, and going for walks, even when it was cold outside. He liked watching sports, especially the Philadelphia Eagles. Nick was very fond of his step-grandkids. He enjoyed playing board games with them, and just making them laugh made him happy."
Regardless of his background, Nick's death is another sad chapter in the Delkamp family story. I hope things turn around for them in 2021. Episode 18 featured the story of 19-month-old Kimani Moore and my first ever podcast interview with Kimani's paternal grandma, Melissa. Kimani died on December 21st, 2018, after his mother, Alyssa Carpenter, called 911 to report she had found the baby unresponsive on his bedroom floor. At the time, Kimani lived in a mobile home on Meisner Road in Old Lycoming Township, Pennsylvania, with his mother and her boyfriend, 21-year-old Jason Forsyth. A few months before Kimani's death, and right around the time that Jason moved in with Alyssa, Kimani's family members began noticing bruises and marks on the baby that Alyssa explained away by saying Kimani had fallen over his toys. He started crying hysterically whenever Alyssa arrived at his grandparents' house to pick him up, kicking and screaming while she tried to buckle him into his car seat. Family members feared something was terribly wrong in the home, but without solid evidence, there was nothing they could do about it. After Kimani's death, an autopsy revealed the baby had suffered
contusions of the head, torso, and extremities, a skull fracture, healing fractures of two of his ribs and one finger,
as well as internal injuries, extensive hemorrhaging, and multiple bruises and marks from prior abuse. Kimani's death was ruled a homicide caused by
multiple acute and chronic blunt force trauma injuries.
Both the Old Lycoming Township Police and Children and Youth Services conducted investigations into Kimani's death. In June of 2019, Kimani's father, Darvin Moore, received a letter from CYS stating that the agency determined both Alyssa Carpenter and Jason Forsyth were indicated for abusing Kimani, meaning the allegations were substantiated by the agency. Individual allegations against each of them, that they had both caused bodily injury to Kimani by beating him, and caused his death through any act or failure to act, were also indicated. That meant that officially, in writing, Lycoming County CYS named both Alyssa and Jason responsible for Kimani's death. Still, no arrests were made. At the time of Kimani's death, Alyssa was pregnant with Jason's baby, a little girl who was born in June of 2019 and removed from their custody. The pair remained a couple until around September of the same year, when they evidently broke up for good. A month later, Alyssa reported to police that Jason had used her credit card several months before to pay a few dollars for the popular online streaming service Twitch. For this, not for Kimani's death, mind you, Jason was arrested and received three felony charges relating to device fraud and theft. He was still incarcerated in the Lycoming County Prison on January 7, 2020, when he was finally officially accused of inflicting multiple blunt force injuries and thereby causing the death of 19-month-old Kimani Zafir Sosa Moore in December of 2018. The charges against Jason included third-degree murder, endangering the welfare of children, recklessly endangering the welfare of children, recklessly endangering another person, and involuntary manslaughter. Since I released episode 18 in June, there have been a couple updates to speak of. First, in July of 2020, Jason and his public defender, Matthew Wielikiewicz, requested his bail be lowered, but that request was denied on July 28th. In late 2019, Alyssa Carpenter rekindled her relationship with Kimani's father, Darvin Moore. In March of 2020, Alyssa regained custody of the daughter she shares with Jason, but the same month, Alyssa and Darvin were arrested on drug charges after a search warrant was executed on Alyssa's mobile home, the same home where Kimani died. Alyssa was able to post bail, but it's unclear if she still has custody of her daughter. Darvin remains in Lycoming County Prison with his bail set at $99,000. Jason is also still housed at the same facility. On July 28, 2020, with Darvin behind bars, Alyssa gave birth to his son, a little boy they named Miano Kimani Moore. Prior to Miano's birth, doctors had already told Alyssa and Darvin the baby would be born with a congenital heart defect and may not survive. Miano suffered from hypoplastic right heart syndrome, tricuspid atresia, and transposition of the great arteries. The little guy put up a hell of a fight, but sadly, Miano passed away on November 4, 2020. Just as Kimani was, Miano, too, was laid to rest in Green Lawn Memorial Park. Alyssa and Darvin are no longer together, and Alyssa has moved out of the Williamsport area. Jason Forsyth's next hearing in Kimani's case is scheduled for 9 a.m. on March 2, 2021, before Judge Mark LaVecchio. In episode 19, I told you about an adorable 2-year-old boy named Frankie Gonzalez, whose mother, Laura Sanchez Villan, reported him missing from a park in Waco, Texas on June 1, 2020. Laura's 911 call set off a massive search involving multiple agencies, including the Waco Police Department, McLennan County Sheriff's Office, Texas Game Wardens, Texas Department of Public Safety, City of Waco Cameron Park Zoo staff, City of Waco Park Rangers, the Department of Family Protective Services, and bloodhounds from the Gatesville unit of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. An Amber Alert was issued for Frankie, who was described as being 2 feet 6 inches tall, with black hair and brown eyes, last seen wearing a red and gray Mickey Mouse shirt, gray Mickey Mouse pants, and black and white Nike shoes. While the search was conducted during day one, detectives interviewed members of Frankie's family. His mother, Laura, told investigators that Frankie had spent the previous weekend with her adult son in nearby Killeen, but other members of the family told police that was untrue. By Tuesday morning, a member of Laura's family contacted the Waco police and told them Laura had confessed what really happened. Police confronted Laura, who admitted Frankie was dead and she had hidden his body in a dumpster behind the Park Lake Drive Baptist Church. Frankie's body was indeed found in the dumpster, wrapped in several trash bags. Laura Villan was arrested and charged with first-degree felony injury to a child with intent to cause serious bodily harm, as well as a parole violation. It turned out that Laura had a criminal record, including multiple prison stints for burglary and violation of probation. She had most recently been paroled in May of 2019. Worse yet, it was soon discovered that in 2015, Laura's rights to her 6 other children were terminated due to her prolonged drug addiction and allegations of neglect. Another CPS investigation was opened in 2017 when tests revealed that Laura had drugs in her system while pregnant with her daughter, who was 3 when Frankie died. Frankie himself was born when Laura was in prison. At the time of his death, Frankie and his sisters, who were 3 years old and 6 months old, were officially in the custody of their father. It turned out that Laura was not the only parent in some way responsible for Frankie's death. On June 17th, Frankie's father and Laura's partner, 28-year-old Lorenzo Gonzalez, was arrested and charged with second-degree abandoning or endangering a child. Lorenzo is accused of knowingly leaving Frankie and his sisters with Laura, despite signing an agreement with CPS, stating he would not leave his children alone with Laura
due to the risk of harm to the children.
A month or so after I released my episode about Frankie, his final autopsy report was released, leading to the August indictment of Laura Sanchez Villallon. Frankie's death was ruled a homicide caused by homicidal violence, including blunt force trauma. The medical examiner reported contusions to Frankie's forehead and scalp, multiple bruises on his arms and legs showing varying degrees of healing, a laceration on his forehead, 3 broken ribs with a total of 7 rib fractures, and a broken right arm that occurred approximately a month before Frankie's death. The pathologist's report added,
"Additional injuries, such as smothering or other forms of asphyxiation, cannot be ruled out."
Additionally, the report stated that Laura confessed to police that on May 28th, she slammed Frankie's head against the wall and later found him unresponsive in his bed. Instead of attempting to save his life with CPR or calling 911, Laura stuffed his little body into a closet and left him there for 2 days before wrapping him in 12 garbage bags and depositing him into the dumpster in the parking lot of the Park Lake Baptist Church. It was also revealed that after Frankie went missing, his 2 sisters tested positive for methamphetamine. Lorenzo told police he thought Laura was doing better, which was why he trusted her alone with the children while he went to work. He and Laura had been separated for a while, but by the end of May of 2020, they had reunited and had been living together for about a month. As I mentioned, Laura was indicted in August on charges of capital murder and injury to a child, and she entered a plea of not guilty. According to the McLennan County Court website, she was assigned an unnamed public defender on August 19th, who moved to withdraw from the case on September 14th. On September 24th, another attorney, Russ Hunt, was appointed to defend Laura. I can't imagine a scenario in which she could be considered remotely defensible, especially after her reported confessions to investigators. The most recent activity on Laura's case was in November, when all parties agreed in writing to use closed-circuit video teleconferencing for future hearings. Laura is currently being held in the McLennan County Jail on a $1.5 million bond. Since my episode, Lorenzo received a public defender. His most recent court activity was when he waived arraignment in August. Lorenzo, who is a citizen of Mexico, is also being held in the McLennan County Jail on a $100,000 bond, but he cannot bond out because he's also being held on an immigration detainer. In episode 20, I told you about 18-year-old Treyana Somerville, who was discovered dead on June 22, 2020, in her family's home on Rowley Street in Governor, New York. Also living in the home were Treyana's mother, 38-year-old LaShawna Charlton, her husband, 45-year-old Rodney Charlton, who was, at the time, deployed in South Korea with the military, and the couple's 13-year-old daughter, Rihanna, who I'm only naming because her name was shared in a multitude of social media posts demanding justice for both her and Treyana. The reason so many people were calling for justice for Rihanna was because the 13-year-old was arrested and charged with second-degree murder in the death of her older half-sister. Many in the community spoke up immediately after Rihanna's arrest with stories of witnessing signs that Treyana's mother, LaShawna, had abused her for years prior to her death. In the 7 years leading up to Treyana's murder, police had visited the family's home no less than 16 times. 25 police reports had been filed on various members of the family, including various allegations of child abuse and neglect. Treyana's stepbrother, Isaiah Samuels, ran away for good from his father and LaShawna's home in 2015 due to his stepmother's abuse, which Isaiah said she doled out primarily on him, although Treyana was also abused. He told of a woman who hit and strangled the children with her fists at first, and later turned to weapons such as bats, belts, and knives. Friends and schoolmates told stories of Treyana living in misery as she was forced to act as a parent in her own home. She was made to do the family's grocery shopping, carrying the heavy bags home on foot. Treyana used to be a vibrant, bubbly girl who earned good grades and excelled at running track, they said, but over time, her grades began slipping. She dropped out of track, and when she wasn't missing from school for days or weeks at a time, she attended wearing hats, leggings, socks, and long sleeves regardless of the weather. They saw bruises and lacerations on her face and body. Once, Treyana attended school with chunks of hair pulled out and a tooth missing. Friends had reported their suspicions of abuse to the school principal and resource officer, to CPS, and even to the town police department, but they said their concerns were brushed off. The same friends described LaShawna as manipulative, telling a reporter that they believed Treyana's mother controlled her daughter's cell phones, messaging apps, email accounts, and social media profiles. Triana was supposed to graduate from high school the month she died. Because of her multiple absences from school, her name was not listed among the graduating students on the program at the ceremony, and a symbolic chair was not left empty for her. After Rihanna was arrested, Lashana retained a defense attorney, although no charges had been filed against her at the time. Many marches and protests took place after Triana's death, demanding justice for her and her younger sister. Some of the marches were affiliated with the Black Lives Matter movement, which stirred up controversy that I found, frankly, disgusting. The protests were quiet and respectful, and the involvement of Black Lives Matter simply represented the way Black people across America are treated unfairly in all areas, from healthcare to education to law enforcement to child welfare to criminal justice. On July 11th, a few days after my episode with Triana came out, family and friends gathered to celebrate and memorialize her. It was not only a memorial service, it was also a graduation party of sorts for the high school senior who should have graduated with her class in June. Triana's diploma case was set up in the pavilion, and attendees lined up to sign her senior class yearbook. Gouverneur Mayor Ron McDougal attended the ceremony, saying,
"We lost a teenager. I lost a neighbor. The community lost a great young person, a member of the class of 2020.
Triana's obituary read,
"On June 22, 2020, God decided that Triana was too beautiful for Earth, and he took her home to his loving arms. She was a quiet, sweet young lady whose smile could light up your soul. Triana was a member of the GHS class of 2020 who had dreams of attending college or joining the U.S. Air Force. She enjoyed her time at school, where she was a dedicated student and track athlete. She would often be seen walking to her favorite places around town to enjoy quiet time. Triana was very kind and compassionate to those that were blessed to know her and will be greatly missed by many."
A few days after the memorial service, there was a huge and much-anticipated development in the case when it was announced that on Wednesday, July 15th, Lashana Charlton turned herself in on a single charge of second-degree manslaughter, to which she pleaded not guilty. Lashana appeared feeble and weak as she was escorted into the courtroom with the assistance of state troopers the same morning for her arraignment. The criminal defense attorney I just mentioned, Melissa Swartz of Syracuse, said Lashana had been hospitalized for most of the prior week, and before that, she had spent some time after Triana's death in a psychiatric institution. Ms. Swartz asked the court to release Lashana on her own recognizance, saying the woman's father was in the courtroom and wanted to take her home to Virginia with him. St. Lawrence County District Attorney Gary Pasqua argued against her release, saying she was a flight risk. The judge split the difference, setting Lashana's bail at $25,000 cash or $50,000 bond. Because her family could only afford $12,000, Lashana was remanded to the St. Lawrence County Jail. As for Lashana's reported frailty, I call shenanigans. In my opinion, she was playing the poor me card as hard as possible to wring every ounce of sympathy out of the court system, the authorities, and the public. This is the same bullshit we've seen multiple celebrities pull when they get themselves in major legal trouble. Think Michael, "I'm so sick I wore pajamas to court," Jackson, Bill, "I'm blind when it's convenient," Cosby, and Harvey, the elderly pervert, Weinstein. As for Rihanna being charged with Triana's murder, at the time of Lashana's arrest, DA Gary Pasqua had this to say at a press conference.
"That charge is still pending at this time. As I indicated, this is a fluid investigation. That charge was laid at that time based upon the evidence that we had and still have. Through the course of our investigation, based on the evidence collected by the New York State Police, there was a belief that there was probable cause to make this arrest today."
When a reporter asked if the ongoing investigation could include anything besides Triana's death, such as pursuing neglect charges against CPS workers, Pasqua answered,
"My focus right now is on the death of Triana Somerville and making sure we do everything in our power to uncover whatever the truth of that matter is and make sure that we do our best to get justice for her and make sure anyone who's involved in that is held accountable. That is our main focus right now. That is the main focus of the New York State Police. I've heard those rumblings. I understand what the community is saying. But as far as I'm concerned, job one is what we're doing now, and that involves her death and the cause of that."
My unbridled glee about Lashana's arrest was short-lived, as it turned out. The day after she was arrested, LaShawna Charlton posted a $50,000 bond and was released from the St. Lawrence County Jail. She has been free since July 16, 2020, and still awaits trial. To make matters worse, court documents obtained the same week by 7 News revealed the details of Trayana's brutal death. The documents stated that Trayana was assaulted on or around June 18th, and her mother failed to seek treatment for her between that date and June 22nd, as the teenager lay unconscious in the home. That's 4 days for anyone keeping score. Finally, on June 22nd, someone called 911, summoning emergency responders who declared Trayana dead at the scene. According to a felony complaint filed by New York State Police Investigator Stephen Boss, LaShawna contributed
substantially to malnourishment and assault,
both of which led to Trayana's death. The complaint stated that LaShawna's
failure to seek proper medical assistance for her
justifies the manslaughter charge against her. I've been unable to find out whether or not Rihanna is still in a juvenile detention center and if her murder charge still stands. I'm hoping there will be some update and therefore some clarity on this case in the near future. Both Rihanna and Trayana truly deserve justice. Episode 21 featured the case of 1-year-old Serenity Sutley, a tiny princess with a quick smile and sparkling blue eyes, who died on October 7, 2017, when her mother, 22-year-old Kelsey Blankenship, found the baby lifeless in her crib in the early morning hours. Based on Serenity's injuries, medical staff and police believed she was raped and beaten to death. When Serenity died, the only people with her in the family's Conneaut, Ohio apartment were her mother, Kelsey, and Kelsey's 37-year-old boyfriend, Joshua Gerdo, who had been dating for about 3 months. Joshua was questioned by police the same day and released, but soon after, he was charged with 2 counts of aggravated murder, 3 counts of murder, 1 count of rape, 1 count of felonious assault, and 1 count of domestic violence. At that point, Joshua went on the run, leading police on a 3-week manhunt that ultimately ended in his capture at a Sheetz gas station and convenience store in Franklin Park, Pennsylvania. Serenity's mother, Kelsey, continued about her life, participating in news interviews about her daughter's murder and so on, for an entire year, until on October 12, 2018, she was arrested and charged with 2 counts of felony murder, 1 count of felonious assault, 2 second-degree felony counts of endangering children, 1 third-degree felony count of endangering children, and 1 misdemeanor count of domestic violence. As a result of Kelsey's indictment, the death penalty specification associated with Joshua's aggravated murder charges was dropped, although prosecutor Nick Iarocci declined to give specifics about why that decision was made, saying that it was the
fair and correct thing to do,
and that the reason
may come to light in the future.
I'd bank on Joshua testifying against Kelsey at trial, but that remains to be seen. In the 2 years since Kelsey's arrest, the 2 cases have crawled at a snail's pace through the legal system, mainly because of dozens and dozens of motions filed by both defense parties. This year, Kelsey Blankenship was evaluated against the wishes of her defense team and deemed competent to stand trial. In June of 2020, a motion her attorney made in July of 2019 was finally denied to suppress a statement Kelsey made to a therapist about having a desire to kill her child. Kelsey's trial was scheduled to begin in May of 2020, but the COVID-19 pandemic caused an indefinite continuance. In September, however, Judge Marianne Cezanne scheduled Kelsey's trial to begin at 9 a.m. on Tuesday, February 9, 2021. The most recent activity on Kelsey's legal case was in December, when subpoenas were sent to no fewer than 33 witnesses, proving that Kelsey's trial will definitely encompass at least several days. I'm strongly hoping it will be live-streamed. In Joshua's case, the same judge scheduled a motions hearing for March 17, 2021, to rule on any pending motions that have not been decided by 1 week prior to that hearing. She also scheduled a status conference for April 7th and set Joshua's trial to begin at 9 a.m. on Tuesday, May 4th, 2021. In the meantime, Kelsey remains incarcerated on the 5th floor of the Ashtabula County Jail. Joshua, too, is still being held in the same facility, although he's on the 3rd floor. Now, this next part nearly sent me flying out of my chair, and I have no idea how it took me 2.5 weeks to find out about it, considering the number of alerts I have set up all over the place. Get this. In December, Ohio Attorney General Dave Yost, Ashtabula County Prosecutor Cecilia Cooper, and Conneaut Police Chief Michael Colby announced that Joshua Gerdo was indicted on December 16, 2020, in a 16-year-old rape case. He was charged with 2 first-degree felony counts of aggravated burglary, 1 first-degree felony count of rape, and 1 second-degree felony count of felonious assault. Although no details are available about that crime itself, the Highland County Press said that a recent review of the case by the Conneaut Police Department and the Bureau of Criminal Investigation's brand new cold case unit led to the resubmission of evidence from the sexual assault that took place on December 18, 2004. Attorney General Yost said,
"This indictment is exactly why we created the cold case unit. The application of today's crime-fighting technology on old cases can lead to long due justice. Science keeps marching on, and so a case that 10 or 15 years ago might have been unsolvable, suddenly, today, in the light of new science, becomes solvable. We can open up a new clue that leads to new avenues of investigation and sometimes to get the bad guy. BCI's cold case unit, along with our law enforcement partners and prosecutors, are going to keep the bad guys up at night. Your sins will find you out."
Prosecutor Cooper said,
"This case is a great example of how much we can accomplish when we work together. Victims of cold cases should never give up hope."
In the 2004 case, evidence was found by Chief Colby's late canine partner, Nick, but forensic testing performed in 2004 was inconclusive. The press said,
"Old-fashioned police work, combined with further DNA analysis, was able to match the offender's DNA profile to Gerdo."
Incredibly, the BCI's cold case unit was only launched in September of 2020, and this was the first indictment connected to the unit's work. According to Ohio Attorney General spokesman Steve Irwin, the cold case unit is currently reviewing evidence from about 150 unsolved cases, including homicides, sexual assaults, missing persons cases, and unidentified remains. How incredible is this? I hope more work like this is done across the country to solve cold cases. Anyway, it's been over 3 years coming, but with trials scheduled for February and May of this year, justice will soon be served for baby Serenity. I don't have any updates on episode 22, only because the subject of that episode was, like episode 1, A.J. Frund, whose case I updated in the last episode. In episode 23, I told you the story of a baby girl named Remy Joan Cohen, whose parents cherished her and whose 3 older sisters utterly adored her. Remy was a perfect angel baby who rarely cried, constantly smiled, and made the Cohen family complete. They never imagined that their precious little girl would be taken away from them after only 16 weeks due to the negligence of the person who was being paid to ensure her safety. While at work on June 6, 2019, Remy's mom, Ashley, received a frantic call from the babysitter, Megan Borges, who barely managed to communicate that something was wrong. Ashley and her husband, Matt, rushed to the hospital in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, where doctors managed to restart Remy's heart. She was taken by helicopter to Geisinger Hospital in Danville, which is coincidentally where Arabella Parker passed away. Remy was admitted to the pediatric ICU and placed on life support. An EEG detected no brain activity, and the following day, on June 7th, the Cohens had to make the decision to remove Remy from life support. She died cradled in her daddy's arms at only 114 days old. Police interviewed the babysitter, Megan Borges, only once on June 6th. She told them that Remy had been spitting up profusely that day, and that around 2 p.m., she herself had become tired and decided to take a nap with Remy's 2-year-old sister, placing Remy on her stomach on a daybed across the bedroom from Megan's bed. 2 hours later, Megan said, she awoke to find Remy purple and not breathing. Despite Megan's history of drug addiction and an extensive criminal history that Matt and Ashley Cohen knew nothing about, police apparently took her at her word. They asked her to take a polygraph exam, which she declined, and investigators simply dropped the subject. Even though the Cohens later found out that Megan was under the influence of methadone at the time of their daughter's mortal injury, that wasn't enough to convince the police even to interview Megan again. An autopsy conducted by Montour County Coroner Scott Lynn determined that Remy suffocated either when Megan rolled over on her or when Remy rolled into the daybed's pillows and blankets and was unable to free herself with no help from her unconscious babysitter. The cause of death was listed as cardiac arrest due to cerebral hypoxia. The coroner felt that Megan's story was not consistent with his findings, refused to rule Remy's death an accident, and recommended Remy's case be reviewed by a medical legal team in Harrisburg, but the Lycoming County District Attorney declined to pursue the case against the coroner's insistence. To this day, no one has been charged in connection with Remy's death, and Megan Borges still has not been interviewed by police for even a second time. A civil lawsuit is still pending against Megan on behalf of Ashley and Matt Cohen. After I released my episode about Remy, during which I had the honor of speaking with her mom, Ashley, I helped create and distribute a petition demanding justice for Remy, as well as launching a letter-writing campaign to several lawmakers and law enforcement personnel, explaining the situation and all but begging them to do something. Ashley and I both received form letters in return from Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf, and Ashley also received a fairly noncommittal response from State Senator Jean Yaw. As for the petition, after we surpassed 1,600 signatures, I printed several copies of the petition, along with cover letters, and sent them to Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro, Lycoming County District Attorney Ryan Gardner, and Captain Sherman Shadle and Lieutenant Gregory Watson of Pennsylvania State Police Troop F in Montoursville. Not one of them responded. I couldn't be more frustrated about the lack of action on the part of law enforcement and the legal system in pursuing justice for Remy. For them to ignore the recommendations of the coroner is unfathomable and, as far as I'm concerned, inexcusable. The Cohen family suffers every day without closure or any type of justice. If anyone has any other information about Megan Borges or any other ideas about continuing to push for justice for Remy Joan Cohen, please reach out to me either on Facebook or Twitter or by email at sufferthelittlechildren.pod@gmail.com. The Cohen family deserves justice. The last story I'll talk about today is that of 5-year-old Josias Marquez, who I featured in episode 24. Josias's story broke in March of 2020 after his partially mummified, significantly undernourished remains were found in a duffel bag in the trunk of his mother's car. Josias, who suffered from a bout of meningitis shortly after birth that left him with cerebral palsy and epilepsy, has been described as high needs, as he was blind, unable to walk, crawl, feed himself, or speak, and completely reliant on others for care. According to police in Wisconsin, Josias's mother, Sigal Abdirshid Hussein, stopped giving Josias, her middle child, his prescribed medication in 2018. She is accused of refusing to provide Josias with any medical care other than the CBD oil she claims to have given him to treat his severe health conditions in place of his prescription medication, and a criminal complaint in the case alleges that Sigal neglected to feed Josias for a significant length of time. When his emaciated, partially mummified body was found in the trunk of Sigal's vehicle, he weighed approximately 20 pounds. Josias, when he was healthy, weighed over 30 pounds at his last doctor visit in 2018. The case came to light in January when Sigal's other two children, a then 6-year-old boy and 2-year-old girl, showed up on a neighbor's doorstep in Howard, Wisconsin, unattended, telling the neighbor their mother had been gone overnight and still hadn't returned. The neighbor called police, and officers soon located Sigal, who claimed she had been running errands. When investigators learned the woman had a third child, she told them his father lived in Michigan and had taken him in January, but she was unable to reach the man and did not have his phone number. CPS stayed on top of Sigal throughout February and March, but she was never able to produce either Josias or proof that he was safe. Finally, near the end of March, investigators received information that contradicted Sigal's statement about the identity of Josias's father, who they determined was a man named James Marquez, who lived in San Jose, California. They ultimately determined that no one other than Sigal herself had reported seeing Josias since November 25, 2019. Due to the inconsistencies in her stories and her refusal to be truthful or cooperate with investigators, Sigal was arrested on March 30th on 4 charges of child neglect. Her other two children were taken into CPS custody, and police obtained a search warrant for her home and her vehicle, which was impounded. The next day, while Sigal's vehicle was searched, Josias's remains were found in the trunk. Sigal, who is now 26, faces multiple charges, including chronic neglect of a child resulting in death, a Class B felony, hiding the corpse of a child, a Class F felony, neglect of a child under 6 years of age with a disability, neglect of a child, 5 counts of obstructing an officer, and forgery, uttering, with the modifier of party to a crime, which means she may or may not have been the primary actor in the crime, but she was at least willing to assist. There is no evidence that anyone else whatsoever was involved in Josias's death or the concealment of his remains. The criminal case regarding Josias' death has been stalled several times in court due to Seagal's insistence on being present in the courtroom for any and all hearings, which was stymied, of course, by the COVID-19 restrictions placed on courts across the country. However, in August, she attended her preliminary hearing by video conference, during which her attorney, Timothy Hogan, tried to argue that there was no solid evidence linking Seagal to Josias' death or his concealment in her vehicle. Keep in mind, she was his only caregiver at that point. Judge Thomas Walsh was having none of this bullshit and ordered Seagal to stand trial on all 10 charges against her. Her arraignment took place on September 29th, at which time she entered a plea of not guilty, and her request to modify the no-contact condition of her bond was denied. Seagal's bond has been set at $500,000 plus another $5,000 for the forgery charge since her arrest in March, and she was ordered not to have contact with her two surviving children, their father, the neighbor who initially called police, and several other people. Seagal's next status hearing is scheduled before Judge Walsh at 1:30 p.m. on February 15, 2021. She is currently incarcerated in the Brown County Jail under Wisconsin's Huber Law, which allows county inmates to be employed during the day and return to the jail at night. Inmates allowed to work outside the jail are held to strict rules and regulations, including the distance they're allowed to travel, the length of time they're allowed to be gone, among other things. I managed to temper my shock and horror at the thought of this woman wandering around outside jail during the day by reminding myself that if she can work, she can pay child support for her other two children. In fact, I do have one silver lining in the massive dark cloud of this story, and that is this. In early October, Josias's dad, James, and his mother, Tina, flew from California to Green Bay to pick up Josias's big brother and little sister and take the kids home with them for good. I am so glad those kids are home with their loving family instead of in foster care, and I wish them all the best. I'm glad to be back from my short break, and again, from the bottom of my heart, thank you all so much for listening, reading, and supporting me in all the ways you do. I can never express how thankful I am to all of you. That's it for this week, guys. Join me next week for a new case. If you like the show, please leave me a 5-star rating and a positive review on your favorite podcast platform. And please subscribe to Suffer the Little Children on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast listening app. Email tips, comments, questions, or case suggestions to sufferthelittlechildren.pod@gmail.com. You can also subscribe on YouTube by searching Suffer the Little Children Podcast. Visit the website at www.sufferthelittlechildrenpod.com, where you can listen to episodes and become a patron for rewards ranging from a shout-out by name on the show to exclusive gifts. Follow the podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and Pinterest at Suffer the Little Children Pod, and on Twitter at STLCPod. View photos related to today's case on Facebook and Instagram. Read more about today's case and many others at sufferthelittlechildrenblog.com. This podcast was written, hosted, edited, and produced by Lane. Intro theme music is by Dream Note Music. Other music and sound effects for the show were created using sounds from audiojungle.net. Hug your babies a bit closer tonight. Until next week, bye guys.